Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming BBC production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Hello, All Souls Trilogy fans. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/allsoulspod. Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
So before we get to the main feature of this episode, we wanted to talk a little bit about the circumstances in which this thing came about.
Well, in
took
case,
part, took place.
And in case you've been living under a rock, the Book of Life is now available in paperback.
Yes. Hallelujah.
And to celebrate that fact, Ms. Harkness went on a little tour. Little tour. Like, she only had, like, what, 4 or 5 stops?
No, I think she had a few more, but a few of them had... There was a little bit of travel trouble on different parts of the tour. So I am just happy, and all of us were, that the events went so smoothly, and she made it to Seattle safely. And when
you
Summer and I...
No, you made it to Seattle.
No, I got to Seattle just fine, thank you. So before we knew the dates and times and places, Summer and I had said to each other, we will do everything we can to get to a West Coast signing. We actually would have loved to go to the LA signing, but it was during the week originally, and we just couldn't take off time in the middle of the week. So when we saw the other possibility was Seattle, we said, absolutely. Well, circumstances turned out that Summer was unable to go.
Well, I can tell you the circumstances. The circumstances are that when we made the decision to go, plane flights cost A. When we finally went around to go purchase said plane tickets,
they were not A.
They were not A anymore. They were like A cubed.
Or CD.
And it was also my daughter's birthday weekend, and I could not leave her and go
of
by
course.
Myself. And the initial plan had been to get 2 tickets and all of us go up to Seattle.
And make a weekend out of it.
Right. And then when the plane ticket prices soared, as they are wont to do, I had to say, nope, have fun.
So Ginger went off on her lonesome.
Which is the beginning of every bad story.
It is. And I won't get into a lot of detail here, but let's just say I had the plane flight booked. The plane flight? That's a little redundant.
Let's just say you've been cured of your love of international hostels.
That is not true.
Okay. You've been cured of your love of hostels in the U.S.
I never had a love for hostels in the U.S. I have a like for hostels, period. But my familiarity with U.S. hostels is so much less than it is with European hostels, because that's where I've done most of my travel. So pretty much, I don't need to stay in another American hostel. I'm not saying they're bad. I'm saying my experience has not been the best. So basically, I made it to Seattle safely. It was a tremendous flight. It was great. It was great company. Security was amazing. Everything was like, this is the flight you want. And because it's darker later. Darker later. So you have a little more sunlight this time of year. I didn't feel unsafe getting the link from the airport to the area, the international district, I guess you call it, of Seattle, where the hostel was. And I knew that once I got there, I'd have to ask around to get absolute directions. It's only a block or two away, but I didn't know which direction to go, and I didn't want to be walking around. I looked like very much like a tourist. I had a dress on, I had makeup on, I had my hair kind of done, so... Yeah, not the best thing to sit there with your phone in your hand and look like someone who's lost. And you're not just lost, you're out of place. So really quickly, I got a taxi to drive me about a block and a half or less. And he's like, here's your hostel. Don't even pay me. I'm like, okay, that's nice of you. Fair enough. Thank you very much.
He's like, I can't take money from a woman who's about to be murdered.
No, I was not about to be murdered. But it was a little unsafe. So I get to the hostel, and I go in, and I pay for, I had reserved it already, but I paid for the night. I paid for the full price for the night. And it was in a bed, a dorm room with three other females. And it was decent security. I didn't feel necessarily unsafe inside, but the whole point was I'm not staying the weekend inside the hostel. I'm there to just sleep and then to go do my thing on Sunday. Well, I met up with some friends Saturday night. So basically my plan was literally to go pay, check in, leave my bag, and leave again to take an Uber or something to go meet some friends at a pub. Well, a few things happened, and I didn't leave my bag because there was nowhere for me to lock it up. And I didn't have exact change. I did not want to spend $8 on a lock that I would never use again. And all I had was a backpack, so I'm like, okay, fine. I'll live. I'll walk with my backpack outside and hang. And at this point, I didn't plan not to return. I just didn't have a place for my backpack, so I was just going to carry it with me. So I'm standing outside, basically like a misplaced hooker or something. I felt like I was overdressed in the wrong neighborhood and getting the wrong kind of attention from people passing by while waiting for my Uber, who canceled on me twice. I have never had Uber cancel on me. And then the third time, thankfully, Uber popped up and it was a different driver. I'm like, thank goodness. Eventually, I got out of there and went and met my friends. And when I was telling people, oh my gosh, I'm staying at this place and it's called this and this is what the neighborhood is, they all looked at me and said, okay, why didn't you tell us you were staying there? Why are you staying there? And you're not going back, correct? Mm-hmm. So long story short, I spent the night with a friend at her house and was very safe. Thankfully, I didn't have to go back to get my bag, so that ended up really well.
No, but I'm sure the hostel thinks that you were just another one lost to the neighborhood.
Maybe. But I ate that $50, but I've never been happier to eat any money than that was. So getting there was a little bit of an adventure, or a missed adventure, because it would have been more of an adventure if I had come back to the hostel. But the whole point of me staying in that hostel was to have somewhat decent access to the activity that was going to take place the next day, and that was to meet a certain person, to have a certain chat. Well, once I moved, didn't go back to the hostel, basically the $50 I ate on the hostel, which was fine, I spent equal or more to that on the number of Ubers it took me the next day to go all over creation to do the different things I was doing. So it's all fine. It all worked out in the end. But it was definitely an adventure. So the reason that Summer and I originally were going to go to Seattle was absolutely for Deborah Harkness's signing, her book signing there, part of her tour. And I was very fortunate to be able to go and attend and hear her speak and wait in line and have some books signed. But I was also very fortunate, the All Souls podcast, I should say, was very fortunate to be able to sit down with Ms. Harkness for a good bit of time and a lovely chat, and we had a wonderful time. She is so gracious with her time, and we are so thankful to have had this opportunity to interview this amazing woman. But before we get to our interview with Ms. Harkness, we want to let our listeners know, first of all, welcome to episode 2, as we said. We're still getting this. Still rolling out the new podcast. Audible.com, if you've heard of them, they do, of course, audiobooks, is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you, our listeners, the opportunity to check out their service. Now, I don't know about you, but Summer and I have busy lives. Summer's got a beautiful child, my niece.
Even if she weren't, she'd still be taking up a lot of my time.
Even if she weren't beautiful. But we, like you, dear listener, we have lives. We have commutes. And when we're home, we don't have time to sit there and shut the door, always, and turn the TV off, turn the clock off, whatever, turn your phone alerts off, and just read on whatever device you have. we don't always have the luxury of uninterrupted time, which is what you want, typically, when you're reading a book. So many years ago, many moons ago, when Summer and I first discovered audiobooks, it has a way of changing your life, especially now that they're not boxes from the library of 25 or 30 cassettes or 30 to 40 CDs.
Oh gosh, no, I remember I got really into audiobooks. I found a place that was like Netflix for audiobooks, and I don't remember what the name of it was, but they would just send me out the discs, and when I would be done with them, I'd send them back, and they'd send me more, so I was constantly had a flow of audiobooks. And what was good about that is that I was able to, at that time, I did a lot of data entry at my work, which was mindless, so I was able to listen to books. So I would listen to books 8 hours a day while I was at work doing data entry, and I would get through sometimes 4 or 5 books a week, depending on how long they were. And, you know, it introduced me to a lot more authors and more genres and things that I would not have made time for. Because I find that in my reading life, the things that I will actually buy books for that I have to sit down and concentrate on, I have a very short list of authors I'm willing to give up that time for. But because of the audiobooks, it allowed me to broaden my horizons and introduce new authors that have now gotten onto the list of authors I'm willing to put things aside for and read for.
And some of your favorite authors now, too.
Yes.
And so in this vein, we are huge fans of Audible.
Oh, yeah.
Because once you purchase a book, it's yours. If you're a member and then you're not a member and you want to come back later on, that book is still yours. And I cannot tell you how many hours of entertainment that my Audible books have brought me.
Well, not only that, but have you ever purchased just an audiobook by itself?
No.
They're super expensive.
For that very reason.
Super expensive. However, when you download with Audible, they're so reasonable. Like, comparatively,
oh,
so
very much
reasonable.
So.
Like, it's almost the same price of what you would get if you just downloaded the Kindle version.
Pretty much.
So, there's a lot of pluses to this program.
So, this being the All Souls podcast, we, of course, would have to recommend book one of the All Souls trilogy, Summer, which would be
A Discovery of Witches.
Yes, ma'am.
And it would be a good time to do this because, from what I understand, there may or may not be a read-along starting at some point.
Oh, yes. We don't have a date, but we do have a plan. So if you have not had the pleasure of listening to the amazing Jennifer Ikeda narrate these books, then we invite you to take advantage of this wonderful offer from audible.com and download A Discovery of Witches as your free audiobook today. Go to audibletrial.com/allsoulspod. Again, that's audibletrial.com/allsoulspod for your free audiobook.
And if that's too much to type and you're already on our website, we do have a link, a little button on the side that you can click that'll take you straight to that. So we're all about saving time here.
That is true, any way you slice it. Take advantage of that. You can't go wrong with a free audiobook.
Free anything. Yay, free.
So as we did in episode one, we asked All Souls trilogy fans to tell us how they found Deborah Harkness's books and what they mean to them, to you. Thank you to everyone who sent us in their feedback. We are thrilled to be able to share a mixture from Skype voicemails and Facebook and Twitter.
Irina from Twitter, she is at Trinity357Z. She says, I discovered A Discovery of Witches by accident while looking for a new book. I was hooked from day one.
And that is what happens to a lot of us. You start it on accident and you're hooked. Violet, also from Twitter, @_V_I_O_L_E_T_, writes, I read about it on the internet. The Discovery of Witches book just seemed to, quote, call out to me. # it was magical.
Jennifer Collier on Twitter, she is JFCollier75, says, I found A Discovery of Witches from a book review from Entertainment Weekly. Then I had to wait 2 months before it was released. I think I remember those emails going out between Entertainment Weekly and Amazon.com. I was being basically profiled and harassed for months before the book came out, and then afterwards, and I finally gave in. So I totally understand that.
Kellyanne Hopkins, also from Twitter, at KEHopkins13, writes, "Found book one on my school library shelf. Best accidental read of the year." Olga P. on Facebook writes, "I found the first book on Audible several years ago quite by accident. The synopsis looked interesting, so as I had credit to spare, I have 2 credits a month subscription, I decided to give it a go. Ended up listening to the first book in just 2 days. The trilogy is now something that I listen to when I have had a bad day or need some cheering up."
And Pam O., also from Facebook, said, "I was reading Parade magazine, which I never do, and I saw a review for A Discovery of Witches. It mentioned a historian and alchemy, and I knew that I had to buy it. And I never bought hardback books. I was immediately hooked. What has the series meant to me? Wow, I have found my voice and lifelong friends. I know I could visit multiple places on several continents and would be welcome."
Lenny Freeman, also on Twitter, at Freeman Lenny, writes, "Staff pick at Barnes & Noble." Aviva Bruckner, hello Aviva, at Aviva Bruckner on Twitter, also writes, "I found Deb Harkness, or better, A Discovery of Witches, in an airport shortly before flying back to Europe from the States. I couldn't get into the right space of mind on the flight, and so the book lay for a bit next to my bed until I picked it up again and couldn't put it back down. The series is inspirational as well as food for thought, and a perfect getaway at once." And we also had some messages left on our listener line. Unfortunately, we don't have names for 2 of them, but the last one is from a caller named Angela. So thank you to everyone who provided their feedback.
"I'm calling to let you know how I found the All Souls Trilogy and Deborah Harkness. I follow E.L. James on Twitter, and one day E.L. James and Deborah were having lunch, and E.L. James tweeted about Matthew and Christian. And so I looked up Deb Harkness and Christian and Matthew and found the trilogy, and I've loved it ever since. Just calling to leave that message. Bye."
"I found Deb Harkness's books after I was rereading Harry Potter for the 15th time and had reread Twilight for the 20th time, and I wanted a grown-up version of both, seeing as how I'm 32 years old. Anyhow, love the books. They've been an awesome journey, and hated to see it end, and I hope to see more in the future. Thanks, Deb. Larissa Muncy here."
"Hi, Ginger and Summer. My name is Angela. I found the All Souls Trilogy in July 2012 through a magazine review of Shadow of Night. I became so enthralled with the series that I had to talk to other readers about it when I was done. I thought it would be the only way to soothe my withdrawal until the Book of Life was published. Instead, it just ended up feeding my happy addiction to the All Souls Trilogy. So since then, I've been talking about the trilogy every single day, and yes, I do mean every single day, for the last 3 years. As a result, I've met a lot of great people in the fandom and now consider them some of my best friends. So much so that we've taken our All Souls Trilogy love to another level and collaborate on a few adventures. Most notably, our fan sites, Armitage for Claremont, and our newest endeavors, Demon's Domain and the All Souls Gathering. So, you could say the books mean a lot to me. Deb Harkness is one of the most intelligent and gracious people I've ever met. Just when you think her books can't get any better, they do, because she has constant reader interaction. It's truly priceless. It's exciting that the fandom is growing and more people are reading the books. As they say, the more the merrier. So with that said, thank you All Souls Pod for hosting this outlet and spreading the All Souls Trilogy excitement."
This interview was conducted at a cafe, and so you will hear ambient noises of dishes and chatter, and we're even serenaded toward the end. So without further ado, our interview with Deborah Harkness. Each book in the All Souls Trilogy is unique, tells part of the story of the characters, and takes us on an adventure. Did the process of writing
any of the books, any of the individual books, move you more than another?
Yes. I think in some ways, Shadow of Night was the one that was the hardest for me emotionally because it had Philippe in it, who is the center of my world, right? So if you think of Philippe as the axis of the whole All Souls world, so because he was physically in it and not just remembered, and because I knew what was coming so clearly, the Book of Life, it was very, very difficult. That said,
yeah,
Book of Life was the hardest to write in a lot of other respects. It was much darker than the other books. There was a lot more sort of atonement and resolution, which is really hard. But I think still for me, probably personally, it was those scenes with Philippe.
Gutting.
Gutting. Very difficult.
And not just Philippe, while that's gutting, they were brighter and great, but because you knew it was coming from the first, you read the first book,
yeah,
the scenes with her father.
Yeah.
That was hard to read. Yeah. Beautiful, but yeah, hard to read.
Yeah. So, you know, in some ways, the first book is a lot about mothers, and the second book is a lot about fathers, and the third book is a lot about children. And that was always, again, sort of part of the way I thought of structure back in the days when I had not written very many words down, but had an idea of this part of the story does this, this part of the story does that, this part does the other. So, yeah.
Thank you. Brilliant. Okay, so the journey Diana takes from a woman who does all she can to stifle down her powers to embodying the goddess and becoming the fullness of the witch she was meant to be is beautiful. Have you found yourself undergoing a metamorphosis akin to Diana through your research in general or through writing the trilogy?
What a great question. Yeah, I mean, people ask me all the time, am I like Diana? And I always say, my God, no. And it's really true. Temperamentally, we're not similar. I think the 30s are very difficult, so I would never voluntarily go back to being 33 again. I feel like, thank God I'm 50, because you know, there's a lot to sort out in your 30s. I think it's the hardest decade. Up until then, you have a script, but I think in your 30s, it's sort of anything goes. Now, that said, I do sort of feel like parts of myself that maybe I didn't even know I'd really miss that were very... I used to do theater. I used to sing. I had a kind of, you know, a creative arts kind of bent for a very long time. But I was so focused on my career and my profession that I do think I'm kind of going back to that place where I can be creative. I've turned into one of those women who colors. So I'm like coloring and writing novels and canning, and suddenly I'm having this, all, being able to do all these things that I just couldn't in my 30s. So I do sort of feel like I'm coming out of some kind of little chrysalis and changing into something else. And that's kind of exciting if you're in midlife and you think, you know, all that stuff, all that exciting change stuff is done. So.
Vampire mythologies are seemingly as numerous today as the stars. How did you develop your unique harpness, vampire mythology?
Okay, well, it had to make sense. So, I'm a historian of science, so what I do for a living is I study and critically analyze how people in the past put stories together about the world that they lived in, how it worked, what their role in that world was. And I wanted the vampires to be able to be sustained in a meaningful way in our world. So there were just things that I couldn't believe that if my neighbor consumed nothing but blood, I wouldn't have noticed. I couldn't believe that if he never went outdoors until after dark, I would have certainly noticed that. So there were just these certain things that I just thought just don't make any sense. And so I started doing research. Is there any creature who only consumes one food? No. I couldn't find one. You know, so there were just these things that just didn't make sense. And so I kept thinking, well, that's the kind of silly thing a human being would make up to make themselves feel better. So that's how I sort of took the existing mythology, split some of it off and turned it into human mythology, and then kept limited parts of it for sort of vampire truth. Because as a reader, when I kind of run into those sorts of elements in stories, I have to sort of check a certain level of belief at the door and really go, okay, right, we're in fantasy land now. And I wanted you to really feel as readers like they could be vampires or witches at the next table. And that's how I did it.
Reading any mythology is fine. You're when you're reading something, you're tapped into that.
Absolutely.
There's no judgment about a mythology. But I understand about having to, if you're trying, you know, because the story is so, it's not overly serious, but it has a serious point to it. It's a serious journey. And so science-based in so many aspects that if that one was so unbelievable, it just didn't fit with your world.
Exactly. And that's how worldviews work, right? So whether it's, you know, there were reasons why people thought this Earth was in the center of the solar system, right? Because I don't see it moving. I don't feel it moving. It's much more easy to explain what's going on if you say that it's the heavens that are moving around.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like they just didn't have a clue. And then once they believed that the Earth was in the center, then all these other things, you know, kind of grow around it. And so it's a very similar process when you're writing a novel that contains that kind of fantastical element. You know, you have to stay true to that, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do, you know, sort of completely fantastical, that's great. But that was definitely not what I was trying to do in here.
Yes.
So some of them have to go.
One of our favorite characters is the Bishop House. What was your inspiration for this wonderfully protective, jovial, magical abode?
I lived in a house in upstate New York in the town next to Madison called Hamilton. And it was early 19th century, and it was my first house, and it was it seemed many, many days like my house was possessed, which is probably true to anyone who's had an older house. It never failed. It, you know, the pipes froze, there were cracks, there was a cistern. I went through a door in my basement and discovered a completely empty 19th century water cistern that then proceeded to like bang and clank all through the winter. I had voles in the wall, these little critters in the wall because I had horsehair insulation, and they used to walk around in the walls and munch on the horsehair. Now, I just kept thinking, as things constantly broke, as floorboards split, as things clanked and critters munched, I thought it would be so helpful if you would, you know, if this house would just do something useful instead of just being a pain in the neck. And so when I was thinking about the Bishop House, it really, I think it was a day. Now I live in a 1929 house in LA, and the garbage disposal had gone, you know, the wiring is terrible. And I remember thinking at the time, I'm just sick of old houses. And then again, thinking, why can't it do something useful? And that's how I started thinking, oh, wait, how about if the Bishop House actually did useful things instead of just breaking all the time? And that's where I got it from. Literally, it was from my experience with these old houses.
Because everything comes back in some way, right? Everything comes back. That made an impression on someone. Yeah.
It's in its own sweet time.
Exactly.
And it has a mind of its own, and it knows what it wants to do. But that's how I feel living in an old house anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish I had more storage, which is why it takes the turkey platters. It's my fantasy to be able to adios the turkey platters, and they just appear day before Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
Use them till Christmas, and then they go back.
They come back. Do you have plans to write? Now, this series is complete.
Yeah.
You have said. So, do you have any plans to write any side series novels, like something that may include Galaglass or Jack?
I don't have any writing plans at all at the moment, and that was a very difficult and very deliberate decision on my part. I've been living with these characters and in this world since 2008. So almost 7 years, exactly. takes a long time. And when I finished, you know, I know for the readers what it seemed like was there were these large gaps in between each book. That wasn't my experience. I just kept writing. I have been writing steadily from September of 2008 till January of 2014, which is when I finished the revisions for Book of Life. That's a long time, and I just really needed a little bit of a break. So I have been not really writing, but just sort of playing around with lots of ideas. And sure, I mean, these are great characters. They're not dead to me by any stretch of the imagination, but we all needed a vacation. So what I'm hoping is that now that, you know, this is the penultimate stop on the Book of Life paperback tour. And what I'm hoping is that this summer I might actually be able to sort of have be in a place where I can make a plan. Because a plan means, yes, I would start sort of writing every day on that one thing. I just don't know what that one thing is. I have a lot of stories running around in my head. Some of them are in this world. Some of them are historical. Some of them are nonfiction. Most of them are fiction. So it just sort of depends on what kind of percolates up. What I keep saying on book tour is that my brain feels like it's full of puppies. Just running around in all directions, and they're all cute and they're all adorable, and I want all of them. And so the hard part is actually going to be in the next couple weeks when I have to say, okay, yeah, I want the black lab, right? And that's the one I'm going to do. Because right now I just get to play with them all and imagine and have fun, and it's nice, but I am kind of itching to get writing again. And fun.
Shadow of Night was my favorite. Besides the time travel aspect and being steeped in living history, Diana got to see her father, spend time with him. This was touching almost beyond words. Have you considered a prequel following Diana's parents? I know theirs is a story we would love to experience.
I have a playlist for most of my characters, and Rebecca and Stephen have a playlist. So if they have a playlist, there's the story in there, right, at some point. I will tell you, my dad had multiple myeloma. So he was diagnosed with blood cancer about the same time that I started writing these novels. So I think and he just passed away on the 21st of May. And I think that I was doing an awful lot of pre-processing the loss of my dad in the books and really thinking about what that was, you know, sort of a, but Diana was very useful to me in terms of being able to imagine what that kind of a loss would be like and the hole that would open up and how you'd stay connected. So, he's a character that even though, you know, he is, you know, quote unquote, dead. I wanted to somehow show all the ways in which, believe me, I got me going, all the ways in which, you know, the dead are still very much alive to us. So, yeah, I would love to do that. I think they must have had a really interesting relationship. And also, I think about what they went through when their very powerful daughter was born. And I think it would be a fabulous story.
Absolutely. The story behind the spellbinding. I mean, good Lord.
Yeah, all that stuff. You know, Rebecca's interest in higher and darker magic. So this is what I mean about
puppies.
Exactly. You know, there's another shiny puppy.
Yeah.
I need to have the ability to be two places in one time. That would be a great spell right about now. So yep. I could you know, be somewhere off writing all these puppies up, and then
yes.
I could also be, you know, sitting here with you and teaching my classes and
going
to the grocery store. That would be even better. So yeah.
Apart from the fact that the way Diana sees things as a puzzle, pieces moving around until they fit together, is magical in the series. Do you have a similar way that you see things when you research? Or what about when forming stories? Do you see pictures, threads, as they kind of develop?
That's a great question. I see London Underground maps sort of things. So whenever I'm in the archive or if I'm working on a story, it's almost as though in my mind I see a route, like sort of connections line up. That's just how I work. I hardly ever know what the heck I'm doing when I sit down to write fiction or when I am writing academic or researching. I just know sort of generally what I want to accomplish, and then I really let the evidence or the characters carry me along. But there always comes that moment where suddenly something will just kind of click. And even if it's only part of the little map, it really does in my brain feel like, oh, okay, right. I take the Piccadilly line from here to there, and then if I switch, and that's the only thing I can think of, is it feels to me like an underground map in London.
I love the imagery. What is your university workload like? What is or are your favorite class or classes to teach?
So I'm a professor of history at USC, and I was teaching full-time, which is four courses a year, two in each semester, and running the graduate program in the history department when I wrote Discovery of Witches.
Wow.
And since the publishing and the promoting, it really is true, I cannot be in two places at one time. And recently, we were able to time the Shadow and Book of Life releases so that they were after my school term ended. But there were a couple of years in there where I really did need to, I wasn't fair to my students, and I went down, I took an unpaid leave of absence for a semester in the fall because I had to promote in Europe for Book of Life, because I can't be in two places at one time. So my university has been really generous with allowing me to take some unscheduled time off so that I can do this. But yeah, but that's sort of the normal thing. And I do an awful lot more of sort of community, a lot of more service through events and talks and LA Festival of Books and things like that that are now related to this, which has helped a little bit in terms of making the two parts of my life integrate.
Work more easily. Yeah. Yeah. Work smarter, not harder.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And what are your favorite classes to teach?
My favorite classes to teach. I love teaching Western Civ, truly, truly, truly. So that's Europe 1400 to 1800. Big class, 250 students. I have graduate students who are learning how to teach as teaching assistants. I love teaching that class because I feel like so many people only experience it through people who aren't passionate about it. And then it is stupefyingly boring. And so my challenge is to actually make it interesting again. So I love that one. I teach a course on queens, witches, and courtesans in early modern Europe. That's really fun. And I also do courses on the history of the book and reading, which I love to do. Because I, as a historian, I'm a manuscript scholar, but I study how people still write manuscripts, even though there's a printing press that they could have used to. So why is that the case? And so to do that, I've kind of had to think about the ways in which ideas are spread around and shared. And I love teaching that course because you can sort of start with clay tablets and then with, you know, electronic tablets.
Absolutely.
And go everywhere in between.
Oh, man.
I love
From the Ten Commandments to your iPad Mini.
Exactly. Right. Writing on tablets. Everything comes around at the end. So yeah, I love teaching that class.
So we share, Summer and I, my co-pilot, share a love of libraries. In six words, what does a library mean to you?
Magic, possibilities, surprises, things unsought, let's call that one word, and immediacy, because when I'm in a library, I have this sense that I really am touching the past by touching those old books. So, yeah, they're pretty special places.
They're amazing. I have said for years, and I'm not the first, I know this, but for now, the only true time travel we have is our books.
Yeah, absolutely.
And libraries are a house of time travel, if you will.
Right.
Yeah.
And as a historian, I get to go into amazing libraries with amazing materials.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and I still... maybe some people take them for granted. I don't. I still remember the first time I called a manuscript for something, and manuscripts are just usually bound up collections of papers and things, and or they can be, and I called up this collection of papers, and I still remember that moment when I turned the page and there was Elizabeth the First's signature at the bottom of the page, and I just stared at it, and then I got up from my seat and I left the room because I was so overwhelmed with that kind of sense of time travel, that signature, that really distinctive, sprawling, beautiful, artistic signature like this at a big as life on the bottom of it, and I was not expecting that because I was looking for something else. That's what I mean about, you know, the surprises.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. It's all of those things, but magical just stands out to me because anything falls under magical if it hits you the right way, I think.
Right. Exactly. Oh. Exactly.
So you've lived in Northern California while attending Davis, UC Davis, and we're also located in Northern California. What do you remember most about your time at UC Davis or living in that area?
I remember bicycles. I remember UC Davis has more bicycles than people, or so they say. I remember I love living in a university town, and I also loved the way that when you stepped outside in Davis, it was so hot and dry, it would just sort of almost sear your nostrils, and there was just that sense, you know, that hot, dry air entering into your body. So I remember funny things about it, but it was a great place both to go as a student, and I also taught there from 1997 to 2004. So I was an associate professor at Davis in the department where I got my PhD degree after I'd gone off and taught somewhere else. And, you know, it was great to see a university town from both a student perspective and then from a faculty perspective. It's a great area. I think it's a really underappreciated area. And, you know, it still has got that farm quality to
Absolutely.
It that I love. As you know, I'm an outdoors girl.
Yes,
so.
You are having a great time. You've explained, and you are, I mean, very successful in what you're doing, both academically as well as professionally writing. Would you ever consider returning to UC Davis to teach or to lecture or to do an event?
Sure. UC Davis was a place, obviously, that had played a pretty big part in my development. What's true is that once you're on the faculty at one institution, teaching at other institutions doesn't work out real well unless you actually have sort of a leave of absence and a temporary appointment.
Sure.
So you don't kind of get to have a movable feast to go around. You know, an event or a lecture is a totally different sort of thing. And I think it's just, eventually I get almost everywhere. You know, somebody said, oh, you finally made it to Dallas, you know, because it's just, there's just a lot of places to get to, and I'm only one person.
You write a very successful wine blog. What can you recommend to someone who is not a wine aficionado but would like to explore wines? And someone who is not that keen on reds but is interested in exploring reds?
All right, so the most important thing is to think of wine as something that goes with food. You know, most good wine is really meant to be drunk at the table with friends and food. It's not the kind of thing you can, you know, drink it like a cocktail, but it kind of destroys part of the pleasure because really something really alchemical happens with food and wine. So the first thing I would do is say, well, what kind of food do you like? So if you love Thai, Asian, sushi, Chinese stir fry, go to the wine store and ask them to find you a dry Riesling, which just goes great with slightly spicy food. If you are trying to get into the world of red wine, the first thing I would tell you to do is to try drinking rosé from southern France. So something from Provence, because it's just gonna be like a stepping stone into those red wines. And then once you go from there, the wine I would start with would be a Pinot Noir. And I would go for Pinot Noir if you can get it from Oregon. It's a little bit more expensive than other places, and it's less expensive than Burgundy. It can take a tiny, you know, you want to serve it cool. A lot of people think, you know, reds are room temperature. Well, if it's 102 in Sacramento, you do not want to be drinking your wines at 102, right? What room temperature means is sort of like, you know, 60 degrees. So pop that. If you're in a warm place, you're going to hate ribs if you don't actually pop them in the fridge for a little while and get them to a place where they're at a... They should, you know, feel refreshing. You shouldn't be
appreciable.
You shouldn't. The first thing you feel is like this waft of alcohol. Either it's a lot of alcohol in the wine, but also the possibility is it's just too warm with the red, and that may be the sole reason you don't like them, is because it's just all you can kind of taste is the alcohol. So that would be my advice. You know, is to. People should try Riesling. People should try dry rosé from Provence, and you know, give Pinot a chance if you're not a red wine fan.
I will definitely try those.
And it goes with everything.
The Pinot
is great with salmon.
Oh, okay.
Fabulous with salmon.
I'll tell Summer because I don't eat fish. She does, but that makes me jealous.
Yes. Very good.
So you say your career in fiction started when on vacation in Puerto Vallarta, you walked through the airport and saw books about witches and vampires on the shelves and asked yourself, if there really are witches and vampires, what do they do for a living? Can you tell us if you've had, this might be a puppy, can you tell us if you've had another similar experience? Has another question begun to germinate?
Yes. But I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Understood. No, that's great. But it's good to know.
Yeah. No. And so that's part of the fun is having that, you know, being struck by something and saying, wait a minute, what? And it's happened in, I've got three that have nothing at all to do with any of the characters in All Souls.
Fascinating.
Three completely different
possibilities.
Moments.
Wow.
Yeah.
So basically, you got plenty of content if you choose to go that way.
My problem is I have too much content. So there's those three, and then there's all the assorted De Clermont and Bishop puppies. And so it's very crowded up there.
Yes. Okay, this kind of is tied in, but not necessarily, really. You said you're writing here and there,
mm-hmm.
but of course you won't discuss what, mm-hmm. because it's still
right.
too early.
Still generative.
Exactly. Can you tell us, if you know, or if you want to share, if it's a new series, so more than one, or a standalone, or is it just simply unknown, or can you share?
I don't know. I think certainly the three that sort of totally independent are standalones.
Okay.
Or at least that's how I see them. And the problem with all the passel of De Clermont and Bishop puppies is that I don't want to just give you more. I want to give you something that is thoughtful and structured and has a point. You know, there's a reason for me to tell you more. And because otherwise, you know, you're just going to roll your eyes when you go in the books and say, oh, God, there's another one. And I don't want to do that to you guys, right? So, that's part, you know, it's the matter of saying, okay, wait, you know, here there's yours, all pack of puppies, but how do I actually, like, gather them together? What's the way to do it? How do I tell those stories? And that's, you know, that's a fairly interesting, complicated question. And I think my mind is working on it. I have some ideas, but the question will be, like, do I want to tackle that? Do I want to tackle these other completely separate things? So.
Regarding the BBC adaptation in development,
mm-hmm.
wherever that is, in the future when that's coming more to fruition, would you consider being involved with script writing?
Sure. You know, it's up to them. Everybody says, do you have control? Nobody has control of anything. This is what I've learned about TV and movies. No one has control. Certainly not me. It's a very collaborative process, which means that you have got to be willing to pick your battles pretty carefully. Now, that said, I'm pretty outspoken. I have a lot of opinions. So the chances of them getting all the way to, you know, a finished product broadcasting with me never having a voice and opinion, I think are zero. That doesn't give me control. Nor actually should it, because I've never made television before. So how do I know, you know? So it's been the development process itself. It sounds really kind of murky and strange. What it is lots and lots of conversations where we sit around and we talk about the books and we talk about the characters and we talk about how it should be structured and where should the breaks be, you know, and what should happen with X situation? Is this really, you know, and or why? It cannot possibly be the books. And it can be the books for a couple of really excellent reasons, which is, you know, for one thing, it's all told from Diana's point of view. So that in itself is a TV challenge if you want a really rich, wonderful story. So there's lots of conversation that will hopefully lead to a point where somebody says, yes, you can hire a writer to write the first episode. That will not be me, because I've never written television before. And then after that, it will take a while from that point to have somebody say, okay, we like that script enough that we're going to greenlight this, and now you can hire more writers and get actors and start filming. So, you know, this is just a really long process, and until it's greenlit and somebody writes a check, a budget check, mm-hmm. you know, we're still in the
it's
land of the hypothetical.
Exactly. Okay.
So, but they're wonderful, and they're very thoughtful, and they really care about book adaptations, the BBC, and getting them right.
Yes.
So I'm really, you know, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic.
Excellent. Yeah, when we saw that it was BBC, I'm like, I mean, hello. What better potential partner?
There isn't
one. For this
one.
Story, I mean, I could have cried gold. It was, or silver, whatever, element. It was the best, and I know no one asked us, because we never thought about this. We just thought, oh, you know, Pie in the Sky.
Yeah.
You always think, oh, your favorite book series, or all of your favorite book series becoming adaptation. I mean, it would be great, right? But the right partner is the most important first step. And when this news was just, you know, announced, oh my goodness, like, who else? We couldn't imagine anything better possibility.
And we had been in conversation since the summer before. So, you know, there's a lot that goes on. I mean, so we've already been through 6 months of conversation, even to get to a place where I felt comfortable with saying, yeah, you can have it.
Sure.
Now we're, you know, in a whole other set of conversations. So it's just a lengthy process. And I know people are really eager for it, but just like with all the bishops and Claremonts, you actually don't want us to just produce something that's fast and not good. Can you imagine?
No.
It's going to be worth the wait. You know,
absolutely.
Hopefully Book of Life was worth the wait. Shadow was worth the wait. I mean, creative things just take time.
Absolutely.
So
the final question.
Okay.
Regarding the series, but not about content or timeline, do you foresee, or would you adore, including any of the music that you are so inspired by in the series?
A great question. I don't know what they'll do about the music. Music licensing is a very costly business. So once upon a time, there was a great series called China Beach with Dana Delaney. I loved it. I watched it all the time. It had a phenomenal soundtrack of music. It was never released on DVD until about a year and a half ago, because they couldn't get the music rights for the DVDs. So I don't know. I mean, all I know is it must be really complicated to do that. And maybe now, maybe it's that when China Beach was first made, home video technologies weren't as important, and it's all done at once now. All I know is it took me till like 2 years ago or a year and a half ago to even be able to own it. There were no DVDs. So I think it would be great. It'd certainly be fun. I know a lot of the artists who are on there are, so there are some really famous ones like Mumford & Sons, but there's also smaller artists that I just really love, and it would be great if something like that. But, you know, hey, there's also really great music that's written specifically for.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, so we'll have
anything that comes with that package will be sublime.
Yeah, I mean, again, the good news is BBC is really good at what they do.
Absolutely.
They produce quality, thoughtful, intelligent television. And they are just, you know, I think they're just the best of the best. So I think you just have to sort of say, great, do what it is that you do and sit back and prepare to be mesmerized.
Blown away.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So
great. Well, that's that's all I had prepared, and it was quite a few. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun. And thanks for devoting part of your busy lives to doing an All Souls podcast.
Oh, no. It's a pleasure. It's magical and history, and it's just, it's so many things that both of us like to sink our teeth into just as fans and as fans of history. It's just so exciting.
Oh, it's so exciting. It was when I listened to it while I was in my kitchen baking some bread.
and
it was great. So I'm really pleased that you've done it and taken it on, and here's to many more episodes. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
How amazing was that? Episode 2, and we've been able to share our interview with the creatrix of this series.
I mean, that's pretty awesome. I've never heard that word before.
Oh, it's a word.
It is now.
It's feminine Latin.
Okay.
If we haven't told you before, because there hasn't been a lot of opportunity, we've had exactly one episode. Ginger's a little bit of a language nerd, or just a general nerd, but especially languages. And Summer is a bit of a Broadway nerd. That nerd may not get to show too much on this show, but we all have our own nerddoms.
You say that like I personally own that nerddom, and I don't.
I never said you do.
You do it worse than I do. Who's the first one to start singing a song?
Oh, yeah.
You.
Thankfully, we made it through this episode without any spontaneous bursting into song, but it may happen, especially during a read-along, because it just may happen, and it might be Ginger, it might be Summer, or it might be Ginger.
Or it will be Ginger.
Oh my goodness. So thank you so much to Deborah Harkness for giving us this opportunity. And thank you, dear listener, for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed this interview, this episode. And we invite you back for much more to come. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. You can find our audio channel at www.audioboom.com/channel/AllSoulsPod. Many thanks to Penguin Audio and Recorded Books for allowing us to use portions of the audiobooks in our show. Visit our website at www.allsoulspod.com. Follow us on Twitter at AllSoulsPod. Find us on Facebook by searching for The All Souls Podcast, or email us at allsoulspod@gmail.com.